Well, thank you for being here once again this evening. Looking forward to another great evening together. Let's pray, okay? Father, we thank you for your blessing and your guiding hand in our lives and in this study. And we thank you for Dave and the massive amount of work that he has put into presenting this information for us, helping us understand some things maybe we didn't before. Father, we thank you for your love and your peace that you bring to us through Jesus. Jesus, we present ourselves to you tonight, and we want to learn from our brother. And we pray your blessing on him as he comes and shares with us now tonight. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Good evening. I'm going to recap just a little bit. The first week, we talked about how God, the Bible, how Christianity shaped Western civilization for 1,700 years before the Declaration of Independence, what effect it had on the founders. And last week, as we discussed the Declaration of Independence, we discussed how much effect God and the Bible had on Thomas Jefferson. I stated last week that the citizens of this nation are under the common law of liberty stemming from God and God's nature as proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence. And this week, we're going to talk about the civil law of restraint that the people imposed on government through the Constitution. The Constitution was framed in a manner that would reflect and protect the philosophy in the Declaration of Independence. That philosophy that says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. That is the philosophy that rules the people, that rules this nation, and that's what the Constitution was designed to protect. It is one of the only negative constitutions in existence anywhere in the world. I say negative constitution because most constitutions are written to say government shall do this, government shall do that. When you write a constitution in that manner, you've opened the door to tell government they can do anything they want to do to accomplish what they shall do. Our constitution is written to tell government very limited things that they can do, and it is salted heavily throughout with absolute forbidding of things that we told them they cannot do. So it is a negative constitution. They laid it out to try to address the shortcomings of other forms of government. At the time that the Constitution was written, we've talked before, they were familiar with ancient democracy, they were familiar with the Roman Republic, but they were also familiar with two existing forms of republic at the time that they wrote the Constitution. As a matter of fact, the convention was called to address the shortcomings of one of those types of republic, the Articles of Confederation. But the two that existed were the Unitary Republic of England. It's still a unitary republic. It has a limited monarchy, and it has a judicial system, but Parliament, the legislature, has supremacy of government over the entire nation. Parliament overrules the monarch, and Parliament in England is the court of final resort, unlike the Supreme Court here in the United States. The problem with that, and the fact that they rely on an unwritten constitution, meaning tradition, is that such a government proves to be just as capable of tyranny as a king, very much capable of tyranny. The other form they were familiar with was a Confederation of Independent States, what we had, the Articles of Confederation. That gives you state rather than legislative supremacy. The problem with that is that the states can opt out anytime they want. There's no real central leadership. So that form of republic leads to, and did lead during the Revolutionary War, to anarchy. So they had to invent a third and completely new form of government when they wrote the Constitution. What the United States is a constitutional republic with elected representatives. We have a written constitution, not verbal, not tradition, written. There is a vertical and horizontal separation of powers embodied in our constitution. The vertical has the federal government responsible for national defense, foreign and federal relations. The state governments are responsible for civil rights, laws, police, and state administrations. The counties are responsible for local county concerns, and the wards are responsible for area concerns. That's how our government is laid out, on the vertical. But to make it even more of a check and balance system, there was a horizontal separation of powers between legislative, executive, and judicial. So I think, since I want to make very sure that everybody understands why it is the government and the government alone that's under the civil law of restraint, we're going to look at the preamble to the Constitution. It says, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Take out the center part for just a moment and look at that. We, the people of the United States, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Folks, the citizens of this nation are not under the Constitution. We are over the Constitution, and government is under the Constitution. We, the people, are the heirs, not representatives, not parties, not any branch of government. We're the heirs of the Constitution. We control it. There are seven articles in the Constitution. Article 1 addresses the legislative branch. Article 2, the executive. Article 3, the judicial. Article 4 addresses state rights and requirements. Article 5 are the two ways that the Constitution can be amended. Article 6 contains constitutional supremacy and the oath requirement. And Article 7 is the validation ratification article of the Constitution. It is today a historical article. It's not something active the way the other six articles are. The founders knew that they were giving the greatest power in the Constitution to the legislative branch. Because of that, they divided it into two separate houses to act as a check on one another. The House of Representatives was to be filled with those who were elected by the people to represent their interests. The Senate was to be filled by the state legislatures to act as a buffer, offsetting populist legislation that could be damaging to the nation as a whole. And they were to represent the interests of the states in ensuring the federal government would not encroach on state sovereignty. That is, of course, assured in Amendment 10 of the Bill of Rights. Unfortunately, with Amendment 17, we began to directly elect senators, and they became nothing more than a rubber-stamp subsidiary of the House of Representatives. They do not represent the states' rights any longer. So we're going to take a look at Article 1, Section 1, because one of the most important and constantly disobeyed clauses in the Constitution is Section 1, Article 1. It says, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives." I'm going to say that again, all legislative powers herein granted. There are no legislative powers given to the executive or judicial branch in the Constitution. An executive directive is not an executive order. That is law by fiat. That's legislation. It is unconstitutional. A court decision is not the law of the land. That would mean that they had legislated, and that is a violation of the Constitution. Only Congress can legislate. Now, I'm going to give you another kicker. There is no mechanism in Article 1 of the Constitution for Congress to give the authority to any other agency or person to write legislation. Every regulation that is set down by an agency and not ratified by Congress is, by the Constitution of the United States, illegal and therefore non-binding on the citizens of the United States. I want you to think about that. Either the Constitution is the supreme law of this nation or it's not. Article 1, Section 2 tells you what's required to be a representative. And the representatives are going to be chosen every 2 years. You have to be 25 years old and a citizen of the United States for 7 years and an inhabitant of the state in which you'll be chosen. Those are just minimum requirements. Section 3 gives the requirements of the Senate that they will be elected every 6 years, must be 30 years of age, and been 9 years a citizen of the United States. Article 1, Section 2, since representatives were going to be a growing population because the population of the nation grew, as the census grew, there would be more representatives in each state. So two things were tied to the census: the number of representatives that each state would have. And do you know what the other thing was that was tied to the census, that was intended to be in direct proportion to the census? Taxes. Article 1, Section 4 through 6 basically deals with the times that Congress will meet, gives them self-policing powers, talks a little bit about the compensation for the job. It doesn't say a lot about you get to give yourself raises whenever you want, but that's what they came up with. It does give them immunity from being questioned or arrested because of what they say or do on the Senate floor in pursuit of their job. And one of the other things that has been badly abused Article 1 says that a senator or representative cannot take another job in government while they're in office. Now, the spirit and intent of that rule was you didn't take another government position until you had fulfilled the term of your office, the 6 years or the 2 years that you were in office. It was not that you would go vote for legislation in a particular way, be offered a plum assignment as a bribe for voting that way, and then resign your office and go take that big plum job. That's not what the intent was. The intent was that you would serve out your term before you ever took another job in government. And obviously, we don't do it that way. Article 1, Section 7 is one that I also want people to stay very familiar with. It says, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. The Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. But I will say that again. All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. There are 435 members in the House of Representatives, ladies and gentlemen. So how many people are responsible for the debt of the United States of America? 435. Not the president and the vice president, not the 100 senators, the 435 people in the House of Representatives. They hold the responsibility for the deficit of the United States of America. They will try to tell you it's the economy. The economy has never one time cast one vote in the House of Representatives. They will tell you it is lobbyists. Lobbyists have never cast one vote in the House of Representatives. The only people who vote are the 435 members of the House. They're the ones we need to send home. Article 1, Section 8 grants powers to Congress, very limited powers. Some people say 17, some 19. For our purposes, I put down here that there are 20 powers given to Congress. There's the power to tax. There is the power to spend, the power to borrow, the power to regulate commerce, the power to establish rules for citizenship, the power to coin and regulate the value of money, to standardize weights and measures.
On that money thing, did they have the ability to give that right away?
No, it's not in the Constitution for them to give that to anyone. We'll touch on that in a little bit. Power to punish counterfeiting, to establish a postal system, to pass copyright and patent laws, establish federal courts, punish crimes on the high seas, declare war, raise and finance armed forces, establish rules for the armed forces, call up state militias, administer the seat of government, administer federal lands, and pass laws to implement the above. Folks, that's the part that tells Congress what they can do. And these things are the only things they can do under the Constitution of the United States. The rest of Article 1 lays out things that they cannot do. In Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, it tells us that all taxes are to be uniform. There was never to be a discriminatory tax system that is nothing more than class warfare. A graduated income tax violates the original intent of the Constitution. It violates ethics, morals, and just plain common sense.
David, you mentioned that we see there that taxes are determined by the
census.
Mm-hmm. The census. What were the sort of taxes that were being levied at that time? Taxes on what?
Well, at one time, the federal government got by on tariffs and excise taxes that they were allowed to impose. For the rest of the budget, if they needed any more money from the budget, that's where the census came in. The federal government brought their budget to the states, and the states paid whatever else was necessary for that budget, from the most populous state to the smallest. The most populous state paying the most, the least populous state paying the least. That's how government got its taxes. The reason that worked well, and why I would insist that we need to go back to that, is because the states were able to act as a check on the federal government and look at that budget and say, you don't need $2 trillion for national defense. These 150 things you have over here, they're not constitutional. We're not funding those things. Go back and rewrite it. So there was a check on federal government. Once the 16th Amendment was passed in 1913 and federal government was able to directly take money from the citizens, there was no stop to government power. We'll probably touch on that a little more in some of my notes as we go.
Last time that Congress ever called up a militia?
Right after the Revolutionary War, I think, was the last time Congress called up the militia.
Is there such a militia now that they recognize?
States still have militias. And the militia and the National Guard are not the same thing. The power to call up the militia was simply the power to call the citizens. The reason we have Amendment 2 to the Constitution is because the Founding Fathers said that the militia is the whole people, everyone. Everyone was to be armed and able to defend themselves and this nation. We'll touch on that a little more next week when we do the Bill of Rights. Well, what they're getting ready to call up, I think, are all the registered owners of handguns, but it's not to go defend anything. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2 gave Congress the right to borrow. Is there anyone that has any doubt that Congress very willingly exercises that right? This was the one power of Congress that Thomas Jefferson said during his presidency so badly needed to be amended, and amended now, because he could foresee that a Congress with the power to borrow money and no requirement to repay money could destroy this nation, and he was absolutely correct. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, Commerce. If you read what the Founding Fathers wrote about commerce, Congress was intended to regularize commerce, not regulate in the sense of enact laws. Congress was intended to act as an arbiter to prevent the states from getting into any kind of economic warfare that would interfere with the commerce of this nation. Congress was never intended to impede commerce itself with laws and regulations such as we have today. Violating the original intent of the Commerce Clause has led to some very unconstitutional doctrines held by the federal government. One is that anything affecting the current of commerce from manufacture to distribution falls under federal authority. Another is that commerce includes all aspects of selling, trading, and trafficking, as well as interstate transportation. Another is that the federal government can regulate any activity which affects commerce directly or indirectly. It can fix prices, wages, working, health, and retirement conditions. The federal government says that all interstate industries are automatically under federal authority for the purpose of intervening in strikes and labor relations. Folks, none of those things is even remotely constitutional, certainly not in the spirit, intent, and ethics of the Constitution, and not, I do believe, legally under the Constitution. Those kind of ideas destroy state rights, individual rights, and they have obviously destroyed the free competitive market in the United States of America. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5. Congress is to coin money and regulate its value. Originally, when the Constitution was written, our money was backed by gold and silver with fixed values. Alexander Hamilton persuaded Congress to approve a United States bank to oversee this process. It was comprised of private bankers, and after 20 years of abuse, even Alexander Hamilton recognized it as a mistake, but that mistake was never rectified. For a short time under Andrew Jackson, the U.S. bank was closed down, but then a second U.S. bank was opened, and in 1913, Congress authorized the Federal Reserve, which is not a federal anything. It is a private corporation. It is not a department of the government. It has no oversight by anyone in the government of any kind. Because it is comprised of private banking concerns, they put us through continual boom and bust cycles. Why would bankers put us through boom and bust cycles? Because they make big money at both ends. In 1933, the United States abandoned the gold standard. In 1968, the government ended redeeming money for silver. And in 1973, Congress makes the United States dollar fiat currency. What that means is it's worth a dollar just because we say it is. Nothing behind it. Today's economy, folks, is completely, completely outside the Constitution. Government is involved neck deep in everything they're not supposed to be involved in, and they have abrogated their responsibilities in the only areas they were to be responsible, such as coining money and keeping its value stable. That is Congress' job, not anyone else's. And there is nothing anywhere in Article 1 giving them the power to hand that over to someone else. Article 1, Section 9 places some restraints on Congress. The first thing in Article 1, Section 9 that I'd like to touch on just a little bit, because I don't want to avoid the issue. Yes, the Constitution of the United States did keep slavery legal. That is a fact. there were quite a few representatives of the Constitutional Convention that wanted to end slavery with the Constitution. They did not have the numbers to do that, but they were a large enough minority that they were able to put the first clause in Article 1, Section 9, which said that after 1808, there would no longer be importation of slaves into the United States. They were able to put that into the Constitution. That was the most they could do. They hoped they could starve out the economics of slavery and end it without any kind of war. Obviously, that didn't happen, but they gave it their best shot. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, no direct tax is to be laid except in direct proportion to the population as determined by the census. What that means is if the government says we need money and we are going to tax the people of this nation 1%, that meant everybody in the nation from the richest to the poorest paid 1% or 5% or whatever it may have been. If you look, and we might look next week, we're going to look at the Bill of Rights, but we might touch on Amendment 17. They made absolutely certain that Amendment 17 said they did not have to lay direct taxes in direct proportion. States very clearly in Amendment 17. If you go on a little bit more into Article 1, Section 9, you'll see that it says no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. And as it goes on to talk about laws, imposts, and duties, it makes it clear that any laws that are passed in Congress are to bind equally the citizens of all 50 states. Ladies and gentlemen, any legislation that has ever been passed by Congress with a sweetheart deal that exempts one state from the legislation or gives preferential treatment to four or five states to bribe those elected officials to vote for that legislation, folks, that legislation is unconstitutional. The Constitution says that the citizens of each and every state shall be treated the same as all states. Article 2 is kind of an interesting article. There's not a lot said about the executive branch in Article 2. It certainly has requirements to be president. You have to be 35 years old. You have to be a born citizen of the United States. But there aren't a lot of powers or limitations enumerated because the executive branch was intended to administer the laws that Congress laid out. The only other duties of the executive branch are to deal with foreign nations, ambassadors, relations with other countries, and when called into service. You know, that's an interesting thing about Article 2. It says that the president shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia when called into the actual service of the United States. Not when elected to office, but when he is called into the actual service of the United States. And I submit to you that the only thing that could call the President into the service of the United States as Commander-in-Chief would be a formal declaration of war by Congress. That is the way that the Commander-in-Chief was intended to be from the get-go of the Constitution. Not, I'm elected, I rule the military in the United States. That's not what was intended for the President of the United States. If you read through Article 2 from beginning to end, you will find no hint anywhere of an executive order. There is no hint of any kind of power of an executive order. Up until Abraham Lincoln, they were always called executive directives, and they were only given to the agencies, bureaucracies under the president, and those directives were given to tell them how to administrate the laws that had been passed by Congress, period. Until Abraham Lincoln tried to suspend habeas corpus and do a couple of other things that were considered orders to the citizens of the nation, a president had not tried to issue executive orders. And by the way, those executive orders that were issued by Lincoln, they were declared unconstitutional. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 says that all presidential nominations, that would be czars, nabobs, or doodads, whatever you want to call them, require the advice and consent of Congress. Require. Not suggested, require. The president has no authority to place anyone in a position of power or authority under him without the advice and consent of Congress, period. That's the Constitution. We start to get into seeing how badly the separation of powers has been abused. The executive branch has the sole power to negotiate with or enter into treaties with foreign powers. I submit to you that when representatives or senators go on fact-finding missions to foreign nations to talk to heads of state of foreign nations without being at the express request of the executive branch, or at the very least guilty of sedition, and I think most of the founders would say guilty of treason. They have no authority to go to any nation and discuss anything with anyone unless authorized by the executive branch. A great deal of power has been ceded to the executive branch by Congress and has been grasped by some stronger members of the executive branch. But the truth is, the president was meant to be kind of a father figure, an administrative figure, yet he was not intended to be a powerful individual. George Washington did his very best to lay the groundwork for what a president should be. He left office after two terms. He would have liked to have left after one. Matter of fact, if you read a lot of his letters and his biography, he didn't want to serve the first term, but he felt that it needed to be done. But not until Franklin Roosevelt did anybody break the unwritten rule that George Washington set by leaving after his second term. Some might say that that had a lot to say about the ego of Franklin Roosevelt. I'm not sure who they would be, but some would probably say that. Article 3 is another article that's a little bit tough in the Constitution. It's about the judiciary. They were intended to be the guardians of justice and the Constitution. There's a major flaw in Article 3. When the federal judiciary imposes its will on the people contrary to the Constitution, there's no ready remedy. There are only two remedies in the Constitution for dealing with the judiciary under those conditions. The first is impeachment. Now, Article 3 does not say that federal judges are appointed for life. It says they are appointed for as long as they are of good behavior, and I would certainly suggest that violating their oath to uphold and defend the Constitution is not good behavior. There is another way that Congress can stem the judiciary. Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2 authorizes Congress to restrict the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court with such exceptions and regulations as it makes. For instance, if Congress were truly, truly serious about the Defense of Marriage Act, all they would have to do is invoke Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2, and the Supreme Court could not hear those cases. So there is a remedy for an excessive judiciary. I said earlier, court decisions, contrary to what gets into the popular vernacular today, are not the law of the land. We go back to Article 1, Section 1. Only Congress can make laws. Courts also have no power under Article 3 to administer laws or their decisions. That is a violation of the separation of powers. But unlike the legislative and executive branches, there are no constitutional requirements for a Supreme Court judge. None.
Okay, quick question. In the Obamacare situation, the court basically held an injunction against the legislation being enacted, and executive branch basically thumbed their nose at it, basically because they do not have the ability to enforce that.
They don't have the ability to enforce it. However, under that separation of powers, the president should be impeached if he refuses to comply with such an injunction. From 1895 to today, the Supreme Court replaced constitutional supremacy with judicial supremacy. The court routinely addresses issues that are not constitutional questions and that are not a matter of rights, and they render decisions on such issues in violation of the Constitution and the will of the citizenry. And I will give you an example. At no time in recorded history, under any law, under any constitution that I am aware of, has marriage ever been listed as a right. It has always been a societally regulated privilege. Some societies would not let you marry if you could not prove that you could support your spouse. Societies have most often said you cannot marry your mother, father, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, or cousin. Societies have said you cannot marry your pet goat or duck. And certainly they've said that you have to be of opposite sex to marry. Those are a regulated privilege. I will tell you now that no court in the United States ever had any judicial right to listen to any case based on a societally regulated privilege. Marriage is not a right. No case should ever have been heard about something like gay marriage. It just should not have happened.
Abortion, the same thing.
abortion's even worse. Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2. It's what we talked about a little bit earlier. That clause says, in all cases in which a state shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. Ladies and gentlemen, when the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, filed suit against the state of Arizona in the District Court of Phoenix, he violated the Constitution of the United States. When Justice Bolton heard that case, she violated the Constitution of the United States. In all cases in which a state shall be party, the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court alone has jurisdiction by the Constitution of the United States.
Of course, the judgment was taken in violation of their office, and they should immediately be taken from office and jailed, correct?
Now, I don't know if they should be. I don't know if they should be jailed, but certainly, if you violate your oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, you stand in contempt of your oath, and you're unfit to serve. You
right.
should be removed from office.
But if he enforces that law, now he has violated somebody else's. My point being is, now it's an injury.
Right.
If he enforces it, it's an injury.
Right. The problem is, we do not have a tricameral government in the United States any longer. We have not had for a long time. I talked earlier about how we were set up in a vertical and horizontal separation of powers, tricameral government. For 150 years, the Democrat and Republican parties have ruled government from local to federal level. We have had a bicameral government, period, for 150 years. With no separation of powers, no checks and balances. The only check and balance between Democrats and Republicans is who gets the marbles. That's it. And if you think that either one of those parties' leaders give one hoot and holler about the citizens of the United States, I want to sell you some pineapple land in the Baja Desert, because they don't. Article 4 was designed to get the states to work together and at the same time protect their sovereignty and provide a buffer for the citizens. Article 4, Section 1 says that each state has the right to have its official acts recognized and accepted by other states. That was designed to prevent a citizen from committing a crime in Missouri, going to Montana, and getting away with it. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 1 provides universal citizenship and rights across the nation. You are a U.S. citizen in Missouri, you are a U.S. citizen in Montana. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2, that provides for extradition, but that clause gives governors the power to refuse extradition and is a power that absolutely denies the federal courts the power to intervene. You might write that one down and read it a little closer. The states have a great deal more power than people think they have. That is Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2. Article 4, Section 3 was the rules for admitting territories as states. We haven't used that one in a while, not since the 50s. Article 4, Section 4 guarantees free elections. Here's one. You better write this one down, too. Article 4, Section 4, Clause 4 mandates federal government to protect the states from invaders without recourse when the states call for protection. There is nothing in Article 4, Section 4, to allow the federal government to refuse to deal with invaders that they prefer to call illegal immigrants. An invader is anyone who enters your home without being invited. If you don't think so, Daryl, you walk into Wayne's house at 2 o'clock this morning and see what the police have to say. Just tell them you're an illegal immigrant. I don't think they'll buy it. Article 5 gives the only two ways in which the Constitution of the United States can be amended. Does everybody in the room know the two ways that the Constitution can be amended? Article 5. Two-thirds of both houses must propose the amendment, or two-thirds of the states can call a constitutional convention. But even after two-thirds of both houses approve an amendment to the Constitution, it requires three-fourths of the states, three-fourths of the citizenry of this nation to agree to that amendment. That's why we have so few amendments to the Constitution. And since the Constitution was written, there has never been another constitutional convention called. The problem with calling a constitutional convention is you cannot limit what will be done by those representatives at the convention once it's convened, and there is no telling what they would or would not write. The very last thing we want is to have to call a state constitutional convention, because we could be in much, much worse shape than we are now. The only thing we need to do is force government to obey the Constitution. Have. and all of those problems will disappear. Article 6 is one of my favorite articles in the Constitution. It says that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It requires elected officials, and not just at the federal level, governors and lieutenant governors, state legislators are required to swear an oath upholding and defending the Constitution of the United States. Most mayors swear an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And virtually every fireman, sheriff, and police officer who has ever put on a badge has sworn an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, the sad thing about that is, I would be amazed if 10% of the people who take that oath know their elbow from their ear when it comes to the Constitution. They have no idea what they've sworn to uphold and defend. They have no idea what your constitutional rights are, and they don't care. That's why we're having this class. I want you guys to care so that we change the people who are up there and they care too. Article 6 also says that there can be no religious test required to be elected to office. Now, remember, the Constitution tells the government what it cannot do. We, the people, can have a religious test if we want to have a religious test. If we say, I don't want anybody who's immoral to be in office, that's our right. We can impose that religious litmus test all on our own when we go to the voting booth. I want to give you an idea of how government changed from the People's Constitution, which is what it was known as for decades. It was not called the Constitution of the United States. People referred to it as the People's Constitution. How did we go from that to government rule? The first biggie was the Civil War. The Civil War was fought over slavery. That was one of the two big issues in the Civil War. But the second big issue was a power struggle between the federal government and the states. Who had more power? Fed or the states? The Union won. Ever since the end of the Civil War, the power balance tilted toward the federal government and has tilted further and further toward the federal government ever since. In 1877, the federal government introduced the Interstate Commerce Commission. And for the first time in our nation's history, agencies rather than Congress were writing regulations that were imposed on the citizens as laws. That was an absolute and outright violation of Article 1, Section 1. And because we the people let it get away in 1877, it's done nothing but get worse ever since. 1895, the Sparf case. Now see, this one's my favorite because I believe in 1895 is when the Fed... I'm going to explain what the Sparf case was. Sparf, S-P-A-R-F-F. It had to do with a murder at sea, which is not the important part. It's what the Supreme Court came out with from that case. I believe absolutely that it was 1895 that the Supreme Court of the United States said, this is not the people's constitution. It is the court's constitution. And we will tell you what is right. In the Sparf case, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. The defense for the defendants argued in front of the Supreme Court that the juries had not been properly instructed. Now, here's why. Prior to 1895, if you were called to impanel a jury, you were there to determine the guilt and innocence of the defendant. But you were also, under common law of the court, going back hundreds of years to determine the justification, and in the case of our nation, the constitutionality of the law the defendant was being tried under. If the law was not just, or not just in this case, or was not constitutional, the jury could not change the law. They could declare the defendant not guilty. And prior to 1895, quite often, justices let the juries know that they had the right of nullification in the case of the law that they felt was being unjustly applied. But the Supreme Court ruled in 1895 that not only did judges not have to let juries know they had the right of nullification, that it was perfectly all right for justices to mislead juries. From 1895 on, judges have not advised juries, they have instructed juries. They have held evidence from juries, evidence that they felt make the case go away they didn't want it to go. Judges have manipulated juries in the United States ever since the Sparf case of 1895.
Dave, one good case, if people want to go look at it, go look up a man named Hoppy Heidelberg. He was a grand jury foreman on the Oklahoma City bombing case. He knew the jury rights. He called witnesses, he called evidence. The federal government sought to fire him. The only one closer to God, the next step down from God in our juries, in our system, is a grand jury foreman. He is rightful of God. He's above all Supreme Court justices. They can do anything they want. Hoppe Heidelberg, go look, if you want to read something about jury nullification and what powers they will use to stop that when people do know their rights, just something interesting.
I would. We've gotten real rusty in knowing what our rights are. And by the way, if the Supreme Court rules in such a way that their ruling violates the Constitution and your rights, that ruling not only is not a law, it has absolutely zero legal binding on the citizenry of this nation.
You said 1877 that ICC, their state.
Mm-hmm.
That's where civil disobedience came up, though.
Who brought that into being? How was that?
Congress brought the Interstate Commerce Commission into being to deal with the railroads. People thought railroads were being unfair. The Interstate Commerce Commission took something that was already beginning to straighten itself out, turned it into a nightmare. The federal government then poured billions of dollars into railroads for the next 100 years, like so many other government programs. Anybody know who our first progressive president was?
Teddy Roosevelt.
Guy by the which Roosevelt?
Teddy.
Teddy, that is correct. Theodore Roosevelt was the first progressive president of the United States, not Woodrow Wilson. It was Theodore Roosevelt who took huge swaths of land in the United States and claimed it for the federal government, unlike anything done before. And Teddy Roosevelt issued 1,006 executive orders as president of the United States. His two predecessors, one of them issued 51 and the other one 71. Big difference. There's another thing I like about Teddy Roosevelt that most people don't understand or don't know from history. In 1909, the first nationally known, popular, celebrity political figure in the United States to endorse the 16th Amendment income taxes was Theodore Roosevelt. He's always being held up as this champion of Republican values. When I look at it, I think he is. Yeah, he... There's not a nickel's worth of difference between the two. Woodrow Wilson used executive orders through the war powers to impose government on nearly every phase of the lives of Americans. The Food and Drug Administration, Grain Corporation, how about Committee on Public Information? Most countries call that propaganda if they're honest. They claimed implied authority under the executive to create all of those departments. Federal Register Act of 1935. Anybody know what that is? There were so many executive orders and so many agency-written regulations floating around that Congress enacted the Federal Register Act, which would contain all of those thousands, now tens of thousands, of executive orders and regulations that had never been ratified by Congress and yet are imposed every day on us as laws. Tens of thousands of illegal regulations, non-binding on us, that are imposed as laws contained in a federal register. Were I to be fortunate enough to be in Congress, one of the first things I'd fight for would be to end the federal register and throw it out the window. There are a whole lot of things I'd fight for, but that'd be one of them. In the Butler case of 1936, I'm not going to try to go through the whole Supreme Court case, but basically the Supreme Court changed the concept that we saw in the preamble of the Constitution that said general welfare. The Supreme Court ruled that instead it was individual welfare. We've been on a downhill slide ever since. When that was decided in 1936, in one generation, the federal budget jumped from $600 to $600 billion a year. One generation. Now we're into the trillions.
Okay, I have a question on the executive order thing. So that's not in the Constitution. The president doesn't have that power at all.
There is nothing in Article 2 anywhere to even hint at a power of executive order. There is no power of executive order.
I had heard, I was Phyllis Schlafly once saying, when you get an executive order, Congress has so much time to do something about it.
No. No, he's not allowed to give an executive order at all. There's no time limit on Congress.
What she's talking about is parliamentary rule. In other words, it's a gentleman's agreement between them. But there is, if Article 2 doesn't declare it, then Congress can say, they can make any gentleman's agreement they want. They are illegal and they should be disobeyed. Not just can be, should be.
Yep, so. That's a fact. I want everybody to read the Constitution closely. That's one of the reasons everybody got a copy when you came to the class. I will buy you a steak dinner if you can find anything in Article 2 that would possibly hint at a power of executive order.
Especially after a revolution where we just kicked a king out.
Yeah. They didn't want another king.
How has it gotten so out of
Because, like I said, once government became bicameral, Democrat versus Republican, there was no longer any separation of powers. Congress is not worried about the separation of powers between the executive and the judicial, and the judicial is not concerned about that. All they're concerned about is who gets all the perks, who gets the power, who gets the gravy.
Answering her question, how can this happen? Well, if you have a time of war, basically they threw the rules out the window.
But the truth is, time of war, declared war or not, War Powers Act or not, Congress could have nipped executive orders in the bud anytime they wanted to. The judiciary could have nipped executive orders in the bud anytime they wanted to. There is no concern about separation of powers anywhere in government. All they care about is who's going to run the people, the Democrats or the Republicans.
So has the population been that ignorant for that long?
Yes. Think, you know, just to be fair, you didn't know that there was no power of executive order in the Constitution. How many other people out there are like that? President says he's got that power, must have it. Well, no, he doesn't. Never has had it. It's not in there.
I knew most of the executive orders that they've been doing are unconstitutional, but the fact they didn't have the right to do that.
That's right. They don't even have the power to give an executive order. There was a case called Oklahoma versus the Civil Service Commission. In that case, the courts decided that the federal government can withhold federal funds to force states to comply to what they want. Violation of Amendment 10, states' powers. Of course, there was the New Deal. It would take a month to list all the things that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did to this country, but he took on huge implied government powers. He issued commands directly to the citizenry, and when those commands were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, he threatened first to use Congress to pack the court by raising the number of Supreme Court judges, and then he threatened to have the judges have assistants who would watch what they were doing because the judges were too old to be making decisions all on their own. In other words, Franklin Delano Roosevelt emasculated the Supreme Court, and it's been that way ever since. They do make rulings, but the Supreme Court has bowed to the executive branch for a long time. Judicial activism. Anybody ever heard that term before, judicial activism?
Before you get started, I have a question about that, because I've been reading something about how that they talk about activism has just come in the last, this past century, 1900, a little bit after that. Well, I was reading about John Marshall back in the 18th.
Sure, the very first decision by the Supreme Court.
And he was like
John Marshall.
1810 to 1860 or something like that. And he was
the one that he and Jefferson butted heads over what the judiciary was supposed to do. Marshall won. Marshall gave the Supreme Court power that is not delineated under Article 3. John Marshall declared that the Supreme Court has the power to rule on the constitutionality of laws, and that's not written implicitly in Article 3 of the Constitution. Judicial activism, yeah, it started as far back as John Marshall. It is true that it did not get as crazy as it's been until the last century, but the biggest violator in 100 years as far as judicial activism was Earl Warren. Earl Warren ignored the Constitution, stated that he was ignoring the Constitution in favor of social necessity, which of course he would determine, and establish public policy, which is whatever the progressives want, that's what we're going to do. That his Supreme Court reversed previous court decisions, Supreme Court decisions, by the basketful. Under him, the Supreme Court began to administer, violation of the Constitution, separation of powers, schools, prisons, great many other things. They openly violated the separation of powers. Didn't hide it a bit. What Thomas Jefferson had to say, clear back during his day, and it was when he was butting heads with John Marshall, "It has long, however, been my opinion that the seeds of dissolution of our federal government is in the Constitution, the makeup of our federal judiciary. Working like gravity by night and day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction, until all shall be usurped from the states and the government of all be consolidated into one. To this I am opposed, because when all government shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks provided and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated." Ladies and gentlemen, today in Washington, D.C., the federal government creates federal standards. It requires adherence to those standards and tells the states if they don't comply, the Fed will do it itself. Those standards are almost always preconceived solutions searching for a problem. it becomes easy to blame the two parties, and they hold a certain amount of the blame. But Americans, people in general, always want to talk about they did it. Well, I hate to tell you this, but we did it. I am not going to lie to you. I have walked into a booth voting for someone with an R after their name who I knew had been unfaithful in their marriage, had done things as a representative at some level of government or another that were at best shady and unethical, if not outright illegal, but I voted for them because they had that R, because they were supposed to be the conservatives. And it finally dawned on me that when I walk into a booth and say I'm voting for the lesser of two evils, I'm a liar. What I'm voting for is evil, period. There is no lesser of two evils. We are the rulers of this nation, not the people in Washington, D.C. We determine the fate of this nation, not the people in Washington, D.C. If we walk into those polling booths 2012 and vote only for people who do not have a D or an R after their name, the entire face of government will change. If you don't take anything else into a polling booth with you, take this rule of thumb. If the candidate has the party's endorsement, they are the last person on earth you want to see in office, because the parties only endorse the people they can control. It's up to us to make a difference. I've said to people before, it's time to stop talking about they and start talking about us. What are we going to do? My studies, my deciding to teach a class on the Constitution, I know it's a primer class. There are a lot of things we could go into. But I don't have 13 or 14 weeks to do even a low-level course at that level. This is all a decision based on I'm responsible, me. I'm responsible as a citizen of the United States to take a stand. I'm responsible as a man who says I'm a Christian, take a stand. And if I run for office again, I can tell you some answers that I would give that are just absolutely necessary. If I were asked by anyone what my stand is on gay marriage, I would tell them the truth. I find it ridiculous and offensive, period. No if, and, or but. We have to take a stand. We're the only ones who can take a stand. The folks in Washington aren't going to take it for us. I see friends getting active in different areas. Sometimes we even discuss our differences in those different areas. But it's time to get involved. It's time to do more than just sit in a corner and complain. It's time to do more than walk out of the booth saying, oh, I didn't have any choice. Yeah, you did. If you had no choice going into the booth, then you should have put your name in a hat and run for office. So there was a choice. You have a choice. Or you should have convinced somebody who you knew was honest to run for it. But that's what I'm here to try to get people interested in. Take back government. Actually, that's not true. You can't take back government. It's already yours. It always has been yours. Just recognize that it's yours and insist on it. Look at your representatives and say, you're the employee, I am the employer, you're fired. Okay? Simple. Not hard to do. Anybody else think it's time to do that?